Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. Today, Tony is going to join us if he can. He's on a very important phone call. These things come up. But I'm delighted to be joined by Joan Byrne. And Joan is one of the founders of The Sail Project. Joan, can you tell me what The Sail Project is?
Well, good morning to you, Martin. It's lovely to be here. The Sail Project, gosh, I think it's the SAIR project is not just a project, it's a concept. And it was an idea. And it was an idea born about, you know, through the people that were involved in it, fundamentally believing in feminist principles and that, and the principles of community development, and that those principles could be applied in an addiction setting. Now, that was something that was very out there and was never tried before. And, you know, what we had in the 90s, this is the mid 90s. Such treatment that did exist obviously focused very much on the addiction and how to treat the addiction and getting the addicted person well or drug free or stabilized, and then off you go. And of course, for those of us that had worked in the field in community development for years before that, we knew that, you know, the root causes of these issues were poverty and disadvantage and exclusion. And unless we took an approach that involved directly working on those issues, ultimately it was just the very odd, very lucky, very motivated person that may have made it through to the other end and you know, managed to sort of change their life around and be more, have a more positive future or whatever. So we knew that as because we worked in that field. And so when the original people who came together in the North Inner City wanted to set up a women's project, it has to be said that they some of them had that vision. It would have been articulated by the community partners in it.
You were all doing something before this. You were all involved in some way before this. What were you doing before this, Joan?
Well, just immediately before this, I was when I went to the SAIR project, I left a position as a researcher with Nexus Research Cooperative. And I had spent a couple of years working with them, which was a great learning experience. I did a lot of social research and travelled Europe. But prior to that, I worked in a community development project in Ballymun, the Community Action Programme, which was one of the nationally funded community development programme projects that were set up in the early 90s. Oh, I went off there for a minute.
Okay, just in the early 90s, Joan, just fire ahead from
the
there.
The early 90s, I started work in the Community Action Programme and I kind of cut my teeth in an employment situation. But before that, for years, I had been involved in voluntary work, in social, in activity and political activity and social activity and campaigns, in organising in my local area. So I had this history and this drive to work in that field. And as a result of that drive, I discovered there was this wonderful program, education route in Maynooth that I'd never known about, never heard about beforehand, the community development program and community development diploma. So I applied for that and got it. And that changed everything for me.
Are you a Ballymun girl yourself, John?
I'm living in Ballymun since 1979, but I was born just down the road in Whitehall.
Walking distance.
Oh, walking, 20 minutes walk max. And I was, you know, I was back to my roots. But yeah, I'm in Ballymun a lot longer now than I was in Whitehall.
Okay, sorry for interrupting you, but go ahead and tell us now, how did you actually put it into process? How did you get SAIL going?
Well, it was a partnership approach, which at the time was I suppose, sexy, and it was happening everywhere. And partnerships were the way to work. And bear in mind that I wasn't involved in the original group that had the idea. I got the job to develop the idea and to create it initially. But essentially, and I have to give credit to a very good friend of mine, Claire Casey, our name checker. She contacted me out of the blue. And she said, Joan, have you seen this ad in the paper for this position? And it was to set up the director of the SAIL project, to set up a new community-based rehabilitation program for women in the North Inner City of Dublin. And she sent the yard across to me, and I looked at the yard, and it was very done very creatively. It had all these buzzwords, and I loved every one of them. This wasn't like anything I'd seen before around addiction. You know, it was all about empowerment, equality, and, you know, empathy and social justice and all these words that I understood. And I had no intention. I wasn't looking for a job at the time. But in my arrogance, I looked at that and I said, you know something, Claire, I'm the only person I know who can do that job. And that's what I actually said to myself. There's arrogance for you.
No, you were.
But I understood all of the bits. I got the picture in this one ad, and that's what attracted me. And I applied for the job and I got it. I had never worked in addiction before in my life. I had no direct experience of addiction. And I had never worked specifically with women. My job as a community worker would have been, in the area of women's specific work. So there I was applying for this job, working in addiction, working with women, setting up this new project. And I got it. And I thought, oh, Christ, but I got it. So it took it from there. That was 1995. And there were a couple, I think, of significant things in the early days, because remember, it was a partnership approach, and we had the health board, and we had various medical people and as well as community people. And we had FOSS at the time, God bless their cotton socks, they were involved as well. And the decision had been made to give a CE scheme to this project. And that was the very first time that CE and drug addiction came together. So they were pioneering it. So we had these bits in place. And it was my job to kind of meld them and bring them together and bring people along. And sometimes it wasn't easy. Because people have very different views on what it should be. The community representatives were very clear, and not so much the statutory representatives, particularly I think that the health board side saw it as a treatment project and, you know, giving people an opportunity to get women an opportunity to get better. But we saw it differently. And I think in the early days, I think it was really important that we managed to include on the, sort of the objectives that we would be a policy lobbying group, and that we would have a social analysis on all our work.
Yeah.
Now, they might sound, you know, grand buzzwords, but once we had them in the objectives, that gave permission to do a lot, to challenge a lot, and to say, we were right to do this because this is what we're supposed to do. So within all of the objectives was all the usual ones about making life better for women, you know, as you'd imagine, and doing education and all that. But these particular objectives, and I remember very clearly wanting to get them included, so that it would give us something to hang on as we move forward, and as the battles inevitably do take place when you're, you know, you're going in a certain direction. Not everyone's terribly happy. For example, that we brought all the women out campaigning for the divorce referendum as their first, cutting their teeth on, you know, political campaigning. And we had them all lying, you know, when Amy Street used to have an island in the middle. You might remember it.
I do.
Yeah. So we had them all along there with their posters and getting cars beeping at them, and the empowerment that they felt that here were people actually supporting them, honking for them. It was an incredible moment for them and started the belief in themselves that they could change things. And in fact, because the divorce referendum was so narrow, the majority, they feel that single-handedly they won it. By doing that work and getting the vote out in the North Inner City, they may have certainly helped.
It's very fair to assume, I think.
But it was great. It was very empowering for them. You know, we had to hold people back from running into to polling stations. So you can't do that. You can't be here, because telling people how to vote. And so anyway, none of them had voted before. None of them had registered. Their neighbours hadn't. Then they did a big drive around that registration. So we took it from there, and every campaign, every social justice campaign that we could get involved in, we did. And they loved it. You know, so that part of it was a huge thing for us. Of course, the addiction issues were there. And of course, you know, we had the experts engaged to help people through addiction and through relapse and all of those issues. But actually having that part of it as the main thrust of the project, other things started to work for people, and other things started to happen for a lot of the women. And some of them have gone on to do amazing things, you know.
And have you seen generational change in it, Joan?
Yes. And it's funny because there was one, it's a kind of poignant, kind of sad moment. When we did the interview for the first round of women, I remember thinking at the time, oh, sweet Jesus, what have I let myself in for? Because it was chaos, like really chaos. And they would turn up when their interview wasn't supposed to be, or late or early, or when it suited them, and all was going on. And one woman came in and she had her, I think, 12, 13 year old daughter with her, who during the whole interview, the mother was very chaotic, very, very, really chaotic. During the whole interview, this young girl was right across the table, just eyeballing me, staring me out of it, right? Yeah. And every so often she'd interject with, "Are you giving me my job? Are you giving me my job? Give me my job." That's what she was saying, right? And I thought, whatever about this woman needing this, that child needed it, you know? Yeah. You know, and I think that was a big thing for me, because we could see the children needed this every bit as much as the adult, and maybe, you know, arguably even more. She wanted her mother to have something, have a stability. And we decided kind of very early on that we would, we had to have a childcare facility in-house. Yeah. Couldn't be done. You couldn't run a women's project without it. And so we developed this saying, no creche, no project. So if for any reason our creche was to go, the project would go too. We would not run it without the other. The two of them are completely interlinked. And so while we have a creche project, which is obviously for the preschoolers, we also have an after-schools project, and we have summer schools, and the older kids all get involved in that. And there's residential programs as well, where the children would come along as a family unit. So they were very much part of SAIL as well.
That was visionary for the time, Joan. That was
extremely visionary. It was. And there's no doubt. And we are still actually the only women's specific project with childcare in the country. There are one or two other women specific projects, which is great. And modeled on, you know, some of the work that SAIL has done, which is marvelous. But we are the only ones with the in-house childcare facility. And that's a terrible shame after 25 years. It's not easy to run a project with childcare side by side in the same.
No, it's not.
But it's crucial for us. We wouldn't have it any other way, you know. We couldn't.
I know, I suppose it's trite to ask you about the numbers of women that have come through, and it is trite because it changes more than just those that come through. It changes the community.
Yeah, that's very true. I think that is important about the community, because the community in the North Inner City was one of the women who worked for me at the time, wonderful, wonderful woman, Kathleen O'Neill, you may have heard of her from Kilbarrick. She made this statement one day, and I thought, this is exactly what happens. She said, the community wraps itself like a duvet around SAIL, and it protects it. And it does do that. Because over that 25 years, initially there was skepticism. Of course there was. People didn't know, you know, what to expect, or maybe didn't care so much. But as time moved on, SAIL has become a community institution. And it is recognised as the place. If a woman goes into the SAIL project, the family and community know good things are going to happen. That they almost feel like they've been somehow saved, you know, from dreadful things. And they know it's a positive space, and they know the good things because they've seen them. And demonstrating it like that within the community is the best way that you can do. And that takes time to build up that trust. But the thing about SAIL is SAIL just doesn't get involved in national campaigns. SAIL gets involved in community campaigns all the time. So if there's a community campaign going, the project, the participants and the staff will discuss it, and they'll work out ways in which how they can support it. And so that's, and therefore the community supports SAIL in its work, you know, in other aspects. So there is this give and take, because the project recognises it isn't just based in a community. It is a community project, and it's a community development project based in its own community. That's what it is. It's not just located there because it's convenient to say it's a project of the North Inner City, but it actually is fundamentally a community development project, and it uses those approaches of empowerment and equality and social justice and education as cornerstones of what it does.
I should have probably asked this at the beginning, Joan, but what does SAIL stand for?
Right. Well, SAIL, the word SAIL in Irish means life, but that's not where it came from. It was Shawnee Lamb who was the original board member. He's still a board member of SAIL, by the way. I had the original idea for SAIL from the community perspective. And it's four Gaelic words. And they are Sashabacht, Obaltocht, Ubber, agus Lain. And that's stability, ability, work and learning. And those four words come together in this acronym acronym SAIL, so which means life. So now he's very creative, obviously, to come up with that. But Shani came up with the name, and that's where it stands for.
And from where it started out to where you are now with it, Joan, how much has it grown?
Oh, gosh almighty. I think nationally and internationally, SAIL is a bit of a phenomenon, you know, particularly obviously in the addiction world. I mean, it's a legend in its own lunchtime in terms of the addiction scene. But SAIL is, you know, doesn't do much navel gazing. It looks out all the time and it makes connections, and it has so many international connections. For example, you know, we did a huge, beautiful, which has been mislaid somewhere in Dublin City Council. I could cry. Mural, a hand stitched and woven mural around the muralistas in Mexico. So we look at international stuff. We look at women's position around the world. And, you know, they would identify with, or somebody might come in with an idea about a particular campaign and look for support, and then SAIL would get involved. So that broadens the knowledge base and also broadens that, you know, that just that sense of we are in this together. You know, the women around the world and people with addiction problems around the world, and not just addiction projects either, but women struggling around the world. And so they get involved in a lot of international work. They get involved every year, the 16 Days of Poverty Action, and they do work, they do displays and speeches and enactments and things down at, do you know, the Customs House Quay there, the installation there, the, you know, the poverty installation, you know, but they do that, and they do Hands Across the Bridge and the Rosie Hackett Bridge. So there's all these key things that they get involved in that's more than them, bigger than them, and that's national and international as well. So yes, it has become very well respected, very well loved, and has got many friends. But the other thing about SAIL, and I think it's not true of everybody, I have to say, because at the very start, being a community development worker, and coming from my perspective, was there's no point in doing things if you're not sharing what you're doing.
Yes.
One of the things that I had seen in my life working in organization or working in community was some organizations who would set themselves up in the community becoming empire builders. And that's not what I wanted SAIL to be. I wanted SAIL not to be an empire, but whatever it had, whatever it developed, whatever it could do, it would share. And that's its resources, its time. It's a very generous project, you know.
Yeah.
And if you look at the SAIL website, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it.
I have, Joan. And it's a lovely website. It's very
well done. Yeah, it's a bit mad at them. I think they're going to get it kind of tidied up a bit. But if there's a section on it, resources section, and all those resources have been developed by people involved in SAIL. And they are available free, download, use them, read them, discard them, do what you want. Things like the reduced use program, which was targeted around cocaine use. There was nothing here happening around cocaine in this country. And back in 2007, we held a conference in Crow Park, which was hugely attended. I sound like Donald Trump, bigly attended. It was great attendance, and there was a lot of excitement. But out of that, the idea of producing a manual, a step-by-step guidance, instructions, literally getting for groups of people wanting to address their cocaine addiction. And bear in mind, SAIL is a group work project.
Yes.
It is about groups, and it's not individual. There are some things, of course, that, you know, there's individual counselling, but it's group work. So to actually develop a whole programme in which, you know, with a bit of training, not so much, but once you had the addiction experience and you had that kind of sense about you and you were a good facilitator, you could run this with your eyes closed.
That's so we did that. That's a really great development. That is really, to do a step-by-step guide on you know, how to set about fixing things.
Yeah, I wrote it. It took me 2 years.
Well, that's some achievement, Joan.
There's a version now, a second version, 0.2, which is obviously much even improved. But yeah, it did take 2 years because we had to keep running it, keep piloting it, keep testing it, keep sending it out, you know, because to get it as simple as we could. So that you could literally take up and say, OK, I've got 10 sessions here with this group. And I'm starting here, and you know, I want to end up here. And the middle bits can be kind of all mixed and matched, but you know, there is a if you want to follow it line by line, if you want to dip in and out a little bit. But when you start there, you must get here, you know, however you get to the end at some point. So there is that. And then there's other resources, the Recover Me resource, which is another one, which is a bit more about in looking at those, I suppose, through that process of rehabilitation and looking at the emotional damage and trying to get more in touch with that side of it. So that's another resource. And there is resources around hepatitis. There's a whole range of resources that have been developed by the SAIL project. And that's there for anyone. Take it. There have been thousands downloaded over the years. Anybody, if you know of anybody, by the way, you know, it can be delivered on a one-to-one basis because it's adapted so that if you want to work with somebody on cocaine, because there's tips and techniques to give people around keeping themselves safe, so you can adapt it, you know. So there's a lot of resources that are online.
Do you find that there's a commonality around the world, Joan? Do you find that the problems women are experiencing in inner city Dublin are the same as women in other countries in the inner cities?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the problems that women experience worldwide are very similar in that there's levels of disadvantage that are not there for other people. There's levels of inequality. There's domestic violence, which is a huge issue in addiction. And to kind of demonstrate that, we got involved, deliberately got involved in a European project at one stage. I think it was back in 2004, if I remember correctly. And it was a program run by the European Commission, which involved a number of partners around Europe. And it was about looking at addiction as a means of surviving domestic violence.
Yes.
Now, that's kind of putting something on its head. A lot of people will think, you know, you experience domestic violence and that leads to all sorts of problems, including addiction.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we were seeing was that women were using addiction to survive the situation as a way of coping. And as a way of not dying, you know, and as a way of just being able to function. And that's a very rational choice. If
you're anesthetizing against the situation. Is
yeah,
that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the domestic violence was there before the addiction.
Yeah.
And the addiction, you know, so we wanted to challenge that stereotype that, you know, well, people are, because of their situation, women, because of the situation, are turning, you know, are because of the domestic violence, are turning to drugs. And, you know, this is terrible. And, you know, but actually those women who are using addiction probably survived more than others.
That doesn't surprise me. That really doesn't surprise me. I'm not surprised by that.
We found that commonality around the world in Europe with other projects. And that was quite revolutionary, quite freeing. And it made a powerful statement that about very powerful women. And within that, we had always, and say I believe this from day one, we always said it, that was the voice of the women, not our voices, were the ones that needed to be heard. And, you know, you don't do that kind of stuff by setting anybody up either. You kind of, you know, you've got to give people a bit of confidence. So you kind of do a little bit of work on that. But you also have to make them believe in themselves. And sometimes you have to push a bit, you know. So from very early on, we made sure that at those, in those moments, in those conferences, in those projects, in that advocacy, their voice, not ours, were the ones that people were hearing. And even if it wasn't exactly what we would have said, it was more powerful than what we would have said, because it was their lived experience and they were able to articulate it in a way that would blow you away and still would. The women, when they speak about their lives and what they've learned and what they want to do with their lives and what they have done, it literally leaves you speechless. Just nobody else could do that, only somebody who's been through it. And their voice has always been the one thing that's been front and of SAIL everywhere we go. So we never go and speak on behalf of. We always, it's a policy. We make sure that we have participants speaking for themselves. That doesn't mean to say the staff don't speak. You know, we do.
Yeah.
You know, look at me. But, you know, in essentially what we're doing is we're making sure that it's their voice. And that's extremely important.
Well, you're pulling up the chair, aren't you? You're saying we're not talking about you. Nothing about you without you.
Without you. And I mean, that's been there from the very, very start. It's an interesting, actually, I'm remembering back. When we started this, we believed fundamentally in education, and you know that's where it was at. And we, because although they wanted to set up a project, nobody really knew what to do. So it was really ours to shape, you know, which is great. So we set up an education project anyway, and we set up a writers group, and they very quickly produced their first book, and that's on the site as well, of poetry. Now, poetry and the inner city of Dublin and addicted women just didn't seem, you know, to map. They loved it. They wrote their own poems for the book. When we set up, we didn't have the place. The building was in bits and wasn't fully renovated. We didn't have tables. But what we did was we got the cardboard boxes that came with the radiator covers, put them between four chairs and made tables. And it became known as the Cardboard Box Writers Group. Very so that was the first book that they produced. And that was incredible. I mean, it was a small book, but my God, what that did for their self-esteem was amazing. And at one point, and I definitely won't name names, but at one point, a particular person from a statutory agency who would have been, you know, involved in maybe not in funding us, but their agency would have been, and would have been particularly high up in that agency, asked to meet me. So I said, okay. So I met with them, and she said to me in a corner of a hotel room, "I'm a bit worried about Sale, that Sale is going off the tracks." Tracks? What? I have no idea what this is about. And I said, I don't understand. And she said, "I'm worried that we're educating the women beyond the norm of the inner city."
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God.
Mm. Now, I think ultimately, you know, she could see that it was a good thing, and maybe, you know, whatever. So I'm not going to come down heavy on her, but that was a thinking that was there at the time. You could give them so much. There's no, you know, don't be raising expectations too high. And my response was, if you want me to actually give less than 100% of who I am, then I walk away now. I'm not doing this job. And you kind of back down.
It must
not always, yeah, but it's amazing, isn't it, Martin?
I think the experience for the women has, and as you said, you put their voices up front, and it has changed those women's lives. But I think it's profoundly changed your life too.
Do you think so? How do you know? You could be right.
Has it?
It has. Listen, I measure things in before sale and after sale. It is one, I suppose, Sale, and I worked there for 16 years before I moved on. I'm now working in Citywide Drugs Crisis Campaign, but before, for 16 years. And again, when I left Sale, I didn't leave it because I wanted to leave it. I left it because the job in Citywide came up, and I thought, where am I best placed now? I've done, you know, kind of be more better placed in maybe a policy arena. And that was the decision, tough as it was, right? Now, I still miss Sale. I think it was a very hard thing to do. But I think after 16 years, it was time, you know, to move on anyway. But I think it's probably the best legacy that I will leave. And I think it'll be there long after me. I think it will, because I don't think, however things shape up in the future, I don't think the community will allow it to go away. It may change. It may shift. I think it's become quite powerful, which in a good way, but obviously it's always under threat. You know, everything is with funding, you know, from government these days. It's always, there's always a worry and a concern. But I think no matter what shape it's in, it will be there for a long, long time, and probably a long time after I'm gone. That's great.
That is great.
Yeah. Yeah, before Sale and after Sale. My life started at Sale.
Yeah. No, Joan, thank you so much for having this chat with us today. It's really great to hear of somebody who's taken something from grassroots, built up something that's hugely successful and very helpful for people, and also something that advocates for people. That's a very important aspect. And we have spoken about how it's not all politics, that movements and organizations outside of politics can influence politics. And
absolutely,
I think you're the living example of that, Joan. And I'd like to say, this is your first podcast. I hope it wasn't I hope it wasn't too bad for you, Joan.
No, it was grand. I was obviously worried about it and nervous, but I've enjoyed it, because once I get started, I do like to talk, as you probably realize at this point, Martin. One thing before I go, and you might want to consider, and we could chat about it on another point, But I'm quite sure that if you did want to do a podcast with some of the women from SAIL themselves, some of the participants, they'd be more than happy, so that they can, you know, and that would make me feel better too, because they can explain to you in their own heads what SAIL is to them, and, you know, so that's just something to think about. And
John,
I'm sure I could
we'd absolutely love to do that. I'll come back to you and we'll set that up, and we will definitely have that. We will definitely have it. John Byrne, thank you so much indeed for your time. And everybody else, thank you for listening.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.